Decoding Life with Ryan Blake. Stay raw, stay real, stay vulnerable, stay authentic. The time is now.
Hello, and welcome to Decoding Life, where we take great ideas from throughout human history and turn them into everyday actions. Apologies for the delay to this podcast. I've been fighting a rather serious illness, but I'm back now. And although Movember is over, you can continue to sponsor us at the link provided in the show notes, and I will continue to put out episodes on a regular basis until everybody who has sponsored us has been given an episode dedicated just to them for their contribution. We have smashed our targets, which is fantastic, and so it's a great help for dealing with cancer and for mental health issues. So thank you to everybody. Today's episode in particular is dedicated to Andreas, who was very generous in his sponsorship. Thank you very much indeed, Andreas. And today we are going to be covering a concept called Leibniz's Law, or the identity of indiscernibles. Don't worry if that sounds a bit complex. We're going to unpack everything into everyday language. So first off, let's discuss who is Leibniz. Well, Leibniz was a German philosopher who was at his peak in the 1680s. And we owe Mr. Leibniz a great debt in many ways for many things. He is basically the inventor of logical computation, and he invented automated calculation. His methodology and theories were used in calculators up until the 1970s, so he's had a profound effect on everyday worldwide history. He basically invented binary, the language of ones and zeros used in computers, and he provided the foundation for what we call today artificial intelligence. In fact, he was developing an artificial intelligence back in the 17th century. He was a polymath, and in so he wrote books on science, politics, and obviously philosophy. He was a very, very clever man, and he lived, or rather he was an adult, during the period of history we call the 30 Years' War, and that war devastated much of Germany. And living through this, Leibniz decided that he wanted to try to help make peace, and he concluded that it was the failure of communication that had led to this war. So he went about retooling language so that it was as precise as mathematics, and he did this by breaking down concepts into the granular level and discovering sort of the meaning behind words so that they could be used more precisely. However, this was just one of his contributions. Today, we are covering something called Leibniz's Law, and we are going to talk about a branch of philosophy called metaphysics. Now, what are metaphysics? Metaphysics is the study of figuring out what existence is, what it is to exist, and furthermore, what actually exists. And so Leibniz's Law, the identity of indiscernibles, is concerned with identity. Okay, now if all this sounds pretty heavy going, don't worry, we will unpack all of it. It's actually not that complicated. Some of it is common sense, some of it is sort of peeling back the curtain behind what you might call common sense. So, Leibniz was concerned with identity when it comes to his law, but he's not concerned with qualitative entity. Now, what do I mean by that? Qualitative identity would refer to something like two twins being the same. Okay, two human twins. Leibniz was talking about numerical identity, and that means literally being the same thing as. Literally. So, everything being identical with itself, which sounds weird or perhaps a bit obvious. So, let's unpack it. So, Mark Twain, the author, is Mark Twain. Okay, that's the same person. Mark Twain has exactly the same qualities as himself. Again, that sounds obvious, but bear with me. Mark Twain was also known as Samuel Clemens. It was a writing alter ego of his. And so, Mark Twain is Samuel Clemens. Again, same person, exact same qualities. So we're not talking about science here. We can know this is true, that Mark Twain is Mark Twain, just by knowing what those terms mean and to whom they refer. So let's take an example of a property. Mark Twain was 1.74 metres tall, and that is exactly the same height as Mark Twain was. He has that same property as himself, what being 1.74 metres tall. All things have the same properties as themselves. Again, still this sounds obvious, but bear with me and we'll unpack this. Because we are dealing with the identity of the indiscernible. So, we have established that all things have the same properties as themselves. Okay? But anything, therefore, with different properties cannot be identical. E.g., someone with two different heights. Now, whilst this might sound a bit of a strange line of reasoning, because, yeah, of course, when you come to discern two things being the same or separate, this law is very useful. For example, when you say your thoughts equal a brain process, they must have the exact same properties by Leibniz's law. You equals your past self. But do you have the exact same properties as your past self? And therefore, are you identical with yourself? Are you the same as yourself in any other possible world? Any world where you did something differently in your life? Okay, any possible outcome? Because Leibniz's law does throw up a lot of interesting ideas, because we deal with personal continuity. You now are a different height than when you were, say, six. And so, are you numerically the same as you were back then? We know that every cell in your body is shed every 7 years. So again, you are not identical with yourself. You do not have the same property as yourself, but you wouldn't argue you're a different person, would you? So Leibniz's law is a good guideline for thinking about ideas like this. So as we're talking about identity, let's apply this to an example that we can all sort of understand. Let's say Clark Kent and Superman. Okay, are they identical? Do they have the exact same properties as themselves? They look alike, they're physically identical, they share the same identity, they're literally one and the same, aren't they? Clark Kent and by extension Superman landed in that spaceship in that Kansas wheat field, and so by extension only Clark Kent can be Superman. No one can take his place, surely. But many have. If you're familiar with the comics, other people have worn the costume. So if the man in the costume doesn't make Superman, if there's more to it than just Clark Kent putting on a cape, what does constitute the identity of Superman? Because according to Leibniz's law, they share all the same properties, and so they're therefore identical. But Superman and Clark Kent have different properties. Think of it this way. Clark Kent has the property of being a reporter for the Daily Planet. Superman doesn't have that property. Superman has Lex Luthor as his arch nemesis, and Clark Kent does not have that property. And as I said before, other people have worn Superman's costume, and each person who's had that costume has acted differently and has had a different moral code than the Superman that we suggest is Clark Kent. But according to Leibniz's law, they have to be identical, and they're not. So there are some inherent flaws in Leibniz's law. It provokes a lot of interesting thought, but it is not 100% accurate as a theory, or as it's mistakenly called a law. There was an American philosopher called Alan Gibbard who put forward a thought experiment, although it is one you could carry out. So we have a lump of clay, and we'll call it Lumpy. We then carve it into a statue that we call Quixote. Okay, statue of a man, beard, armour, you know the drill. Now, they have an identical quantity of matter that makes them up, and they have therefore identical properties, the amount of clay used. So there's no part of Lumpy that isn't Quixote, and vice versa. They have the exact same properties. But if we smush Quixote back into a block, the Quixote part is gone, but Lumpy is still around, or he's returned to visual form. Which means that although you can say they have identical quantity and identical properties, part of what it is to be Quixote is inherent to being in that specific shape. Quixote isn't Quixote unless he looks like Quixote. Lumpy doesn't have that same requirement of being in a specific shape. He is just a lump of clay. So Lumpy and Quixote seem to be identical because they are the exact same thing, just in different shapes. But how can they be identical if one can exist while the other doesn't? You see, the question of identity is a very, very fragile one. And Leibniz's law, in its flaws, is incredibly useful as exposing these properties. So from this, we can discern that when it comes to identity, there are two kinds of properties: essential and accidental properties. Now, an accidental property, what's that? It's something that can be taken away from an object without making it a different thing. For example, a dog that's missing its tail is still a dog. Therefore, we can say a tail is an accidental property. So we're talking about the critical mass of identity. The same thing would apply with, say, a cyborg human. If a person lost their arm and it was replaced with a robot arm, or indeed just not replaced with anything, you'd still say that person was a human. Okay, and again, with that argument, we can talk about things like, at what point does a human stop being a human? If you lost all your arms and legs, we still consider those people to be human. Now, if you were a brain in a jar, are you still a human being? Especially if you're given the means to communicate, like a voice box or something. So then we come on to essential qualities, which are much harder to find. What is the critical mass of being a thing or a person or an entity? Let's look at something else in nature, just to sort of talk about this. Let's say we've got a tree, and at the time of this recording, it's now winter. Most trees have lost their leaves. But you would never say that the tree was not a tree because it has lost its leaves. In fact, not at all, because losing its leaves is part of its natural cycle. So a tree without leaves, we would generally say, is still a tree. If we turn a tree into notebooks, is it still a tree then? Where in the process does it lose its essential tree-ness, if you like? Is it when it's chopped down? Well, generally, we still refer to a dead tree as a tree. You know, we just put the prefix dead on it. A dead tree is still a tree. Does it lose its quality as being a tree when it's pulped? Again, good questions. Where is the essential quality, and when is the essential quality gone or changed? And the same thing applies to any existing entity at all. When does a human stop being a human? When would a dog stop being a dog? And so we come back to, if you recall, we talked about this in previous episodes, existentialists. An existentialist would deny the existence of essential qualities. Nothing comes a priori. There's no inherent thing about anything that makes it that thing, if that makes sense to you. We can actually go back to sort of pre-Socratic ancient Greek philosopher called Heraclitus, who said, and this is still used today in common parlance, you may have heard this expression, you cannot step in the same river twice. Nothing is identical to itself, because everything, including you and the river, is perpetually changing, always moving. Your chemical composition moves, everything about the river moves. So it's not the same you, and it's not the same river.
This looks like a job for Superman.
So by this reckoning, Superman wasn't the same Superman even after the first time he flew. He's a perpetually changing entity, and he's never identical with himself. So we come on to this idea of persistent identity, because obviously the Superman we saw flying past yesterday is the same as the Superman we see flying past today. Intuitively, that's how we think and feel about any item, but let's use Superman as an example. So with persistent identity, we have this idea that we imbue objects with a value. We say, this is worth something to me. For example, it's a rather played out sitcom trope, but you're looking after someone's pet, say a bird, you accidentally kill it, and you go and replace it with the same type of bird. Now, if the person comes back and realizes that, they're upset because they imbued that pet with value. Now, I know it's a living thing, and one might argue that all living things have inherent value, but for example, your neighbor's pet dog doesn't mean as much to you as it does to your neighbor. So in this instance, the person whose bird has died and been replaced would get very upset, saying, that's not my bird, that's not my pet. But by extension, let's say you borrow £20, a £20 note from your friend that's sort of lying there on the table, and you just don't have any money, you need it, you go out, you spend it, you draw £20 out of a hole in the wall machine and put a new fresh £20 note on the table, and you tell your friend, I had to use that £20 note, but I've replaced it. There, you can see it's a different £20 note, but the person doesn't get upset. Why is that? The persistent identity of that £20 note is basically irrelevant. Now, we come onto this concept called fungibility. Okay, fungibility. And that is the property of an object being interchangeable with other objects of the same kind. When we replace the bird, the person gets upset because it's not a fungible object or entity. Replacing the £20 note, completely fungible. Money is fungible because it's a placeholder for represented value, and the value is what we care about, not the item itself. However, we don't have a pet bird for the sake of representing all birds everywhere, and so that is not fungible, that is not interchangeable. You have a specific interaction with that bird or dog or whatever pet you've got. So Leibniz's law, applying to memories, says that, well, we can imbue objects with value and identity. For example, you may drink from a certain mug every day, and because it was given to you by someone you care about, that mug is not fungible. But if you go to work and just use whatever mug and wash up and use whatever fresh mug, those mugs are fungible. So we have this issue here with persistent identity and imbued value, because the two mugs in this example have two very different values, but they could be identical. They could be exactly the same mug in every measurable, testable way, except you care about one and not the other. So by Leibniz's law, no two separate objects can be exactly alike, or it'd be the same object. So by extension, we come on to a philosopher who was greatly influenced by Leibniz's law. He used it as a dividing device for his own philosophy, Descartes. Now, you may know Descartes, the French philosopher who said, I think, therefore I am. We're not going to unpack that. That's a topic for another day. But his main theory was something called dualism, which is that the mind and the body are two separate entities. And he used Leibniz's law to define this. And you may agree with him, you may not. We'll unpack that now. Descartes said, I think, but my body does not. That was his supposition, and he uses Leibniz's law to prove this. This is called an argument from doubt. Okay, when you cast doubt on something and make an argument based on that doubt. So it's a simple four-step process that Descartes used. I cannot doubt I exist because I'm thinking and therefore I am. But I can doubt the existence of any physical thing. That's much easier to do. And then he went on to say, I therefore am not identical to any physical thing. Therefore, I am a thinking thing that is not equal and identical to any physical thing. So he established his dualism that way, as mind and body being separate, because he could doubt the existence of a physical thing, but not his mind. Therefore, they did not have the exact same properties, which meant by Leibniz's law, they must be two different things. Now, another flaw in Leibniz's theory is something called the substitution fallacy. Leibniz's law is not applicable to elements such as beliefs, doubts, hopes, or fears. Okay? Because these are something called intentional states. They are states that are of an individual characterized by intentional properties. And an intentional property can be said to be of or about something else. So you might have the same hopes and dreams as somebody else, but that wouldn't make them identical. It would make them identical entities. So basically, anything like that, any ephemeral mental ideas that you have, cannot be discerned or covered by Leibniz's law. It's an empty area for Leibniz's law. And now we come on to another element that's critical regarding Leibniz, and it kind of shows part of the flaw of his thinking is, unfortunately, it's just from the time period he was in, because there are certain things he couldn't conceive of because of the evolution of society and science. So we've got something called near indiscernibles. So let's say we've got two spheres and they're identical except one's got a bump on it, but then we smooth out that bump without affecting the other or any other objects. The spheres are therefore now identical, completely identical, which means they should be one entity according to Leibniz's law, but they're not, they're two separate objects. Okay, so this idea of a near indiscernible becoming identical, something going from a being slightly different to being identical, is not covered by Leibniz's law, because if they've got the exact same properties, they must be one entity. So again, we've got a flaw here in Leibniz's thinking. Another argument that counters Leibniz is from a philosopher called Wiggins. He used an argument from absurdity, reductio ad absurdum, which means you take someone's theory and run with it to what you might call an absurd extent. You take it to its very, very logical end point, following it through to the letter, until you're left with something that's absurd. So what does that mean in this instance? What was the reductio of the identity of indiscernibles? Okay, very simple. Let's say that Leibniz is right and the identity of indiscernibles is true. Then once again, we suppose there is a perfect sphere made of pure iron, 1 mile in diameter. Actually, the size doesn't matter, but let's just say 1 mile in diameter for the sake of it. And we call it A. Then we take another perfect sphere made of pure iron again, 1 mile in diameter again, and we call it B. Since the identity of indiscernibles is true, A simply is B. It has to be by this rule, by Leibniz's law. But let's keep this going. Reductio ad absurdum. Since A is perfectly spherical, its left and right halves are exactly alike. So think about that. If they're exactly alike, they must be one entity, because something is identical with itself. So that means, in effect, you've only got one half sphere, because if the two half spheres are identical, they must be the same thing, they must be one. So you've only got half a sphere now. But that also means the half sphere would require exactly similar quarter spheres, which means the two quarter spheres cancel each other out because they're one item, because they're identical, because of the identity of indiscernibles. But each quarter sphere has the exact same properties as the other. Therefore, by this law, there's only one. And so, you're down to one quarter sphere. You can see where I'm going with this. Therefore, again, well, there must be only one eighth sphere, because those are two perfectly symmetrical, identical properties, which by this law means there's only one, and so on and so on. And this goes on forever until there's nothing left, basically. Because if you use this reductio argument, which holds true, it means nothing can be exactly symmetrical. And we know now with modern science and what have you, things can be exactly symmetrical. They can be perfectly symmetrical, which disavows Leibniz's law. Now, Leibniz did actually cover this in one of his many letters to one of his philosopher friends. But he covered it just by saying he didn't believe anything could be identically symmetrical. But remember, at that stage, he didn't understand subatomics as well as we do now, two identical electrons occur in nature, etc. So Leibniz's law is hamstrung by Leibniz's ability to know things outside the sphere of science at his time. So it's a very interesting but flawed theory, but it throws up a lot of interesting ideas about what makes up identity that we may not have considered previously. And that's the strength of Leibniz's law, is looking at it and realizing it has pointed out several interesting ideas about what are we, what makes us us. Okay, so Leibniz is a trailblazer, and that's what's important about this law. And again, it's useful for discerning things and applying certain elements of it to everyday thinking. Coming up in the next few episodes, we will be covering personal identity, which is a very different element from numerical identity. And we'll be talking about what makes us us over time, and what elements of self persist and which don't. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you again soon.
Thank you for listening to Decoding Life. Please like, subscribe and leave a review, and also follow our video feed on YouTube, Decoding Life. If you have any comments, questions or topics you would like us to cover, please contact us on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook, or with the name @DecodingLife1. That's the number one. Or by email, decodinglife1@gmail.com. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are entirely our own and do not represent the opinions of any entity whatsoever which we have been, am now, or will be affiliated.